I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. Chris Turner joins me now to talk about his new book, The Geography of Hope, A Tour of the World We Need Amidst the Cacophony of the Grim Warnings of the World's Future. He has traveled the world seeking a sustainable future, searching for plan instead of panic. Chris Turner is the author of the international bestseller Planet Simpson. He is the recipient of 4 National Magazine Awards, as well as the 2001 President's Medal for General Excellence. The Geography of Hope, published by Random House, retails for $34.95. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Chris Turner. Good morning, Mr. Turner.
Hi there.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
This is a hopeful book, rather than some of the sort of grim warnings that we've gotten from other authors. Is that part of your nature to look on the bright side, or was it a conscious attempt to get away from the Al Gores and so on, these to borrow Bill Sapphire's wonderful phrase, these nattering nabobs of negativity?
Yeah, I would say probably more on the conscious effort side than the by nature side. If there was a natural progression there, it had to do with the birth of my daughter, where and the realization that sort of comes to you as a parent that you are now, you know, you feel morally responsible for, you know, making sure that the world that they are going to grow up in and grow old in is sturdy enough for them to enjoy the, you know, the kind of life you've had. And, of course, you look at that sort of time horizon now, 50, 60, 70 years out, not just for yourself. I mean, you can be, you know, sort of glibly nihilistic about your own existence, but, you know, this is someone whose livelihood depends on you and the kind of world you give to them. And I think that was probably... That was the motivating factor for what was ultimately a conscious effort to see if there was enough hope out there to sustain sustain us. Basically, I call it my year of living optimistically. I thought, let's go see what there is to see, and the great part about it was that I finished the trip far more hopeful than I began it. My expectations were exceeded basically in every turn.
Talk to me about your daughter's birth. It seems that you hadn't thought of these things before, or just because she was your daughter, you thought of her future a little bit more than you said, let's say, other kids.
Well, I think obviously it's something I had thought of before, and you know, I'd been writing on environmental issues as often as I could for a few years. I think the sense of urgency, and this wound up sort of dovetailing with you know, the sorts of reports we were starting to get from fairly august scientific quarters saying, you know, the urgency is indeed great. I think it just, you know, there is an ability to kind of distance yourself from a problem of this scale and magnitude and time frame if all you're really thinking about is yourself. You know, however you choose to phrase that. Whereas, you know, as a parent, again, there's this sort of moral imperative to make sure, basically, that there's a future durable enough to sort of support their hopes and dreams, and that's, I guess, sort of what I went looking for.
And you took your daughter on this journey, did you?
She was along for a lot of it, actually. Yeah, not quite everything. There were chunks of the trip in Europe and parts of Asia that she didn't come along for every single thing, but she was there for a bunch of it. You know, she was there in Thailand, you know, meeting the architect who built homes that produce more energy than they consume. She was along, you know, crawling under the desk of the mayor of Lakewood, Colorado, where they're sort of figuring out how to make suburbs sustainable. And, you know, she really, in a way, I like to think that, you know, maybe some of her earliest memories will be of seeing this sort of bright new future.
You had some experience with Greenpeace, and I read that somewhere. Mm-hmm. What was that like?
Well, I was a canvasser for summer for Greenpeace in 1993, I think it was. Between years of undergrad. And, I sort of signed on because, you know, it seemed to me, you know, that there was sort of no more noble thing to be doing than you know, committing yourself to environmental issues to some degree, and plus I needed a job. And it was ultimately an extremely disheartening experience, mainly because, you know, you sort of, as a canvasser, you're knocking on people's doors, and, you know, the same as someone who's doing door-to-door work for, say, a political candidate, you're ultimately saying, you know, here is a worldview that I believe in enough to be knocking on your door and telling you about it, and I want you to sort of join in, give us some money, get a membership, whatever. And it was an unconvincing worldview, not because what the not because it was, it wasn't true, it was true what we were telling them, but it was just so incredibly bleak and terrifying, and it seemed to me that there had to be a better way to get people engaged in this than scaring the pants off them.
You know, it's funny, I asked that question because last week I interviewed Amanda Sussman, and she's got a book called The Art of the Possible.
Right.
And she was much in the same boat that you were in. She thought that joining Greenpeace would be what she would do to make the world better. And she found the same experience, that she thought it was better to do other things, to be more hopeful and perhaps influence the system a different way. You traveled the world. You went to a number of places. We'll go through the list here in just a sec. But well, let's stick close to home, to where I live and where you are this morning, Granville Island.
Mm-hmm.
What did you see there, and what's sustainable about Granville Island?
Well, I mean, for starters, Granville Island in and of itself is indicative of a much broader reinvestment in urban life. I think that's been one of the great stories. The better-known story is the suburbanization of North America, but one of the really great stories of the last, you know, 20, 30 years has been this reinvestment in urban spaces, and Granville Island obviously was an industrial kind of waste that has now been turned into this vibrant sort of cityscape with a market and all those sorts of things. But really probably the coolest thing about the time I spent there is I met with a guy named Mark Stoiber, who's an advertising guy. Started his own agency called Change Advertising after many years, you know, being Mr. sort of big shot international advertiser, rebranding stuff for Procter & Gamble, winning awards at Cannes and that sort of thing. And Stoiber basically came in as the guy, you know, who is going to these sort of small entrepreneurial green businesses and saying, you need to start thinking like Procter & Gamble. This is, you know, this is a company that spends billions of dollars figuring out how to convince people to want the things that they want. This is what you're trying to do. You're trying to do the exact same thing. They're the ones who are the best at it. Why wouldn't you use their tools?
And I guess he's one of these eco pioneers that you've come to admire.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me. So, Granville Island's been around for 30 years or so, but there were other places. Lakewood, Colorado, mm-hmm. is a suburb of Denver.
Yes.
And what did they do there?
Well, Lakewood was it's an older suburb, but sort of it's a, you know, a lot of the housing dates to the 60s and 70s, but pretty typical, you know, suburban Denver sprawls like crazy. Not a lot of there, as the famous saying goes. And basically, Lakewood had this huge shopping mall at the center of it, as a lot of suburbs do. And the shopping mall was essentially dying. It had about a 30% vacancy rate. The parking lot was crime-ridden. It was really becoming sort of the center of what was thought of as sort of a collapsing community. And rather than sort of slap on a new coat of paint, as the saying goes, and, you know, changing the name, which, you know, across town in Aurora, where I lived for a couple of years as a kid, that's what they did. They just changed the name of the Aurora Town Center. Made it look a little prettier. What they did in Lakewood was they leveled it to the ground and basically built an urban downtown. They built gridded streets with wide sidewalks and, you know, shop fronts and parallel parking and offices and condos above the shops and really just built a downtown for a city that has never had one.
And is this in all the communities that you've gone? You went to Manchester. You went to Germany. You went to a place in India.
Mm-hmm.
A couple places in India, your own hometown in Calgary, Aspen, Colorado. Do you find that this is something that people are hip to, that this is what they want to do, to become more sustainable? Because it's become so fashionable, hasn't it?
Right, and I think that, I mean, that is certainly one sort of a stream flowing into this sort of larger river of change, if you will. I think the thing about this is it's happening for all manner of reasons. There's you know, businesses that are deciding to do it to make a profit. There are other businesses who took the initial first step out of a sense of moral or ethical obligation. There are communities that are doing it very, very, you know, deliberately with the idea of we will be a green community. And then there are places like, you know, Lakewood, Colorado, that are doing it just because, you know, the mayor attended a new urbanist seminar and realized that, you know, there could be more to a suburb than you know, residential, you know, curvilinear street communities. And what the kind of common thread weaving through all of this is that however all, you know, however all of these organizations, communities, people came to take that first step, they immediately found the reward so much greater than they expected. And this is the great thing about sustainability as sort of a, you know, organizing concept for the 21st century, is that when you really commit to it, it has this sort of multiplying effect. One thing leads to five others that lead to 25 others, and you very quickly find, you know, that you decide to do one thing, say for aesthetic reasons, like Seaside, Florida, which was one of the first new urbanist communities, the first new urbanist community, which decided mainly for aesthetic reasons to leave the dune that faced the Gulf, the Gulf of Mexico. They would leave it, they wouldn't level it and build condos on top of it, which is the norm. And as it turned out, that was also a great way to protect the community against hurricanes. You know, there's just this sort of multiplying effect once you commit to this.
And how has the developing world been coping with living sustainably?
Well, obviously, it's at least, you know, in rhetorically speaking, it's pretty far down the list. If you go to a country like India, they are concerned with abject poverty. They are concerned with industrializing their economy, growing it, you know, sort of joining the modern world. What happens, though, is that, you know, and this is where, as scary as some of the statistics being thrown up by a country like India, a country like China are, they will, you know, look at the best ideas we've got going, and if they make, you know, sort of social and economic sense, they'll grab onto them. I went to the first LEED Platinum, that's the U.S. Green Buildings Council standard LEED, the first LEED Platinum building, which is their highest rating, was built in Hyderabad, India, the first one outside the United States, I mean. And that was basically because, you know, it was clearly codified. This is what you do. This is how you do it. And it's followed the steps, and it worked. And it has spawned, you know, a couple of dozen more projects like that. It's now becoming sort of the thing you do as a, you know, hip, modern, you know, Indian software firm. Say you want a headquarters that says, you know, you belong to the future. They're now building to LEED standard instead of building glass cubes.
And because we've heard a lot about that the developing world should, China and India as well, should not follow the mistakes that North America has made. And you've noticed that they're heeding our mistakes and not repeating them?
I think both are happening simultaneously. And I mean, I know the Indian case better than the Chinese case, you know, at least on the ground. And I mean, you do see, obviously, this very sort of Dickensian cityscape in parts of India where it really does look like sort of 19th century industrialization and dark clouds and big factories and all that sort of thing. The thing is, though, that you know, there's no inherent necessity to following that pattern. You can skip the queue, so to speak, and leapfrog. And the analogy I make in the book is to the rise of the sort of digital telecommunications revolution in India, which saw basically a country that, for example, never really had a modern telecommunications infrastructure. There was never really good phone service universally available in India. And what's happened is they've skipped that era entirely, and now you see cell phones everywhere. And you know, the sort of lowliest rickshaw driver will have his own cell phone. And this is in a country where, you know, it takes years, literally years, to get a landline. So I think that's sort of a model. You look at the energy grid in India, and it's terrible. There are rolling blackouts in the cities. Half the country still doesn't have electrification. There's no reason to build a grid and then turn it into a renewable thing. You can just move directly into these renewable technologies, which makes sense at a village scale anyway.
How did you travel the world on this year of living optimistically?
How did I get around, you mean?
Yeah.
Pretty much by every means known to humanity. There's obviously a lot of air travel. There was, you know, trains and buses and boats and cars and, you know, basically whatever was, you know, most convenient to the place that I was in. And obviously, you know, that came with a certain amount of compromise. Sometimes you'd really rather not have to take a car. Sometimes you'd really rather not have to fly. But there was really no way to kind of report this story the way I wanted to without traveling a lot, obviously.
And on this book tour, how have you been traveling?
Again, mostly by air. I have bought carbon offsets, if that's the question you're driving at.
Yeah, I was just wondering, because I read something in the Globe and Mail that you'd written about that you were somewhere, and then they were sort of, they looked at, how they traveled to that place. I think it was in Germany, correct?
Yeah, I was at a conference in Germany, and the discussion was, so it was mainly these European, British and continental European journalists and activists, and in Europe particularly, where you know, choosing to fly instead of take the train, because you can get you know, you can take the train almost anywhere if you want to. The rail network is there, so choosing to take a short hop flight, because short hop flights are fairly cheap and easy these days in Europe, was kind of, you know, kind of a little bit gauche. And of course, someone asked me how I'd gotten, how I'd arrived at the conference, and I said, well, I took the train out for Hamburg, and I got a big round of, kudos, but no one sort of said, well, how the hell did you get from Canada? Because obviously the answer there is a transcontinental, airplane flight.
So Samsø, Denmark, you hold that as an example that we should all heed. Mm-hmm. It's an island, but what's the population, about 5,000 people or so?
4,400, I think, roughly.
And what have they done there that we can learn from?
Well, what they did there, on the surface, what they did was they eliminated fossil fuels almost entirely. Their net emissions are actually negative now. They eliminated fossil fuel from everything except their cars, and then they built a wind farm to offset, an offshore wind farm to offset the emissions from their cars, because that was sort of more expedient than, waiting around for someone to build a zero-emissions car, which is obviously, one of the holy grails of this thing, and seems to be coming closer. But really the amazing thing about Samsø was, this was a not particularly wealthy by Danish standards, really, really conservative agrarian society, so people who are not big fans of radical change. And the great sort of lesson from Samsø is how you implement the kind of shift that we need to make socially, how you get people engaged in it, how you get everyone involved, how you, in the Samsø case, how you go village to village and explain to as many people as needed, explain to them why this is good for them. And obviously, we don't all live on these, sort of agrarian Danish islands, but we all do live in communities. And the way you would do this would be different in any given community of 4,000 people, but the tools to do it do exist. It's just a matter of building the sort of collective will the way they did in Denmark.
Do you see the collective will in urban settings like here in Vancouver, where you live in Calgary? I read in the book that New York City is arguably the greenest city in North America. Do you find that there is a will to continue that elsewhere?
I think it's certainly, I think the winds, so to speak, are blowing that way. I think people are talking about this a lot. People are engaged by it pretty intensely now. I was actually, to use the New York example, I was just in New York actually a couple weeks ago, and went to an area of Brooklyn that's sort of just on the edge of, hip, upscale Brooklyn, but sort of in the borderlands between this very sort of upscale part of Brooklyn and, sort of old order ghetto, basically. And this couple basically decided that they would buy and renovate a couple of buildings, and they got started on it and with very little experience in the field of general contracting, and decided to go green. And what's happened is by making that decision, the sum has become much greater than its parts. There's a residential building and then sort of an artist studio building. And, they filled that building to capacity, the studio building, without ever moving off of Craigslist in terms of their advertising. The demand for green office space was so strong that they didn't even really have to, have to put up a for rent sign. So I think that, this is very anecdotal, obviously, but I think the sense that this is really what people increasingly want, and really, in contrast to previous generations of environmental activism, this is not about returning to the land. This is about reinvesting in cities and making cities work as well.
Overall, you're still very hopeful, are you?
More so than ever, actually. That's been the great thing about this, is that I just keep. My main frustration is that this is not where the conversation resides. The example I frequently use is of this housing development in Freiburg in southern Germany that is 50 odd middle class townhouses, standard in every respect except that they produce more energy than they consume. This is the house has a power plant, and to the best of my knowledge, the only reason every house isn't a power plant is because we haven't demanded it. And to my mind, as a rallying point for a much better way forward, demanding that your house be a power plant is a pretty good place to start.
And it is affordable, is it?
It's certainly becoming affordable. Yeah, in that specific case, the initial startup, depending on where you are, there are incentives to do it in Germany. There aren't here yet. So the initial startup cost is a little steep, but obviously over the lifetime of a building, if it is a net power producer, or even if it is just generating power during its downtime while you're off at work or whatever, that's going to in the long run pay for itself and start to turn a profit.
Chris, it's been fascinating talking to you. I did enjoy reading the book. It is instructive and it is hopeful, and just a fascinating journey around the world. I mean, people should pick it up simply for the travel, I guess. Thanks for joining us today, Chris.
My pleasure.
Yeah, has anyone ever this meant just to close out here? I just realized when I was asking you about your daughter, and this is so self-indulgent and stupid, and I'm perhaps insulting you. Has anyone ever said that you sound like Seth Rogen?
No, I haven't gotten that.
I just, listening to you talk about your daughter, I'd seen Knocked Up about 2 weeks ago.
Right.
I saw you on television this morning, with the beard, and I couldn't get that out of my head for the last 20 minutes or so.
Well, I can live with that, that's all right. I mean, particularly now that Seth Rogen has made the, I guess the sort of bearded, slightly disheveled look kind of hip in its way. I can dig that.
For the last 20 minutes, we're talking about very important things, and I can't seem to get that out of my mind. So I do apologize for that.
No problem. Yeah.
And I do urge that people pick up this book. It is a great book. The Geography of Hope, A Tour of the World We Need, published by Random House, $34.95. For the commentary, I'm Joseph Plantov.